This may surprise everybody in the room. I have no problem with the Confederate statues at all. I just think they should be erected in the Confederate States of America.
That's right. Welcome to Theology Live, a podcast and live event that highlights the playful dance between theology and contemporary life. This iteration of our young adults ministry at Grace St. Luke's was started over 2 years ago by the Reverend Broderick Greer. In that time, Broderick has worked to build a community and a space void of easy answers and empty platitudes. Instead, he has helped produce something remarkably relevant and simultaneously nuanced. An experience you and I yearn for in the deepest part of ourselves. I want to personally express my gratitude and best wishes to him as a mentor and friend, as well as offer thanks to him and to all of you for having me as your next host of Theology Live. Our guest this evening is the Reverend Dr. Andre Johnson, Assistant Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Memphis, lecturer at Memphis Theological Seminary, senior pastor of Gifts of Life Ministries, and the founder and managing editor of the Rhetoric, Race, and Religion blog. I am so pleased to have Dr. Johnson here for his second appearance on Theology Live, and tonight I will be interviewing him on the intersection of theology and race, focusing on the recent white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, and the work he and others are doing here in Memphis with Take 'Em Down 901. I am Meredith Day, Minister of Youth and faculty member at Grace St. Luke's Episcopal Church and School, and this is Theology Live. Well, good evening, Dr. Johnson. I'm so glad you're here.
I am just honored to be here, Meredith, and congratulations to you for being the new host of Theology Live. Y'all show her some love. Meredith Day, ladies and gentlemen.
You are too kind.
She is awesome.
We are
just so blessed to be in your presence tonight, and I am much better because I am sitting across the table from you.
Well, you are very, very kind. So I know in Broderick's last episode with you, he just gave you a hard ball, like right off the bat. We're going to start a little easy tonight.
That's right.
Just like he said, it is a massage. I want you to start with asking you to tell us, just tell us more about yourself. Some folks in the room, you have students in the room.
Yeah.
Tell us about your life in Memphis. Just what are you up to these days, and what kind of projects are you working on that you're most excited about?
Well, I'm glad you did mention the students in the room. I do want to shout out the class at Memphis Theological Seminary. We are studying the prophetic ministry of Dr. Henry McNeil Turner, and I just want to shout out the class tonight. Go class! All right. They are here. Normally we meet on Thursday nights, but they were insisted that they come here. But a little bit about me, I don't know. I just try to live a faithful life. I try to follow who I believe is my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, and try to live that life, and to live that life more abundantly as it relates to following the teachings and the ministry of Jesus. And by doing so, it just leads me into different arenas. First, the educational arena. As you mentioned, I am a professor at the University of Memphis and also at Memphis Theological Seminary. I try to write some stuff, and I try to leave some sort of a legacy behind in that way. But I'm also, I'm proudly say that I am an activist. I am a scholar activist. I try to not only teach it, but practice what I teach and preach. I'm also a pastor. I try to live faithfully in that as well. But I don't look at it as wearing three different hats. I look at it just being all under the same umbrella, because I am profoundly first and foremost human. And what that means is that I cannot just take off any of those hats and just, try to be somebody else. I bring all of that to any situation, any place, any situation that I find myself in. And it is in that space that I try to live a faithful, authentic, And that's another key word that I like to throw around, an authentic life. So I am who I am, and I don't see any kind of quandary about it at all.
Wonderful. Thank you for introducing yourself. Yeah. Okay, now we get to the good stuff, which is after the election of Donald Trump, we heard a lot of white progressives in America asking this question of, like, how did this happen?
Oh.
While we simultaneously heard the voices of a lot of our friends who are people of color who were not surprised by his election. Similarly, you know, many white people claimed that they were shocked by the events of Charlottesville, while many in the black community were not. And it seems that part of this white people's shock kind of stemmed from how public our lives are these days, and just sort of the audacity to be out in a world that is so photographed and videotaped.
Yes.
That I think that's where maybe some of the shock came from. But I suppose in the simplest terms, just tell us, why are white people surprised by this, and why are folks in the black community not?
Wow, that was like right down the plate right there, just a fastball.
I know you're
gonna
hit it out of the park.
And I'm just going, no, I'm just, you know, I wasn't ready. I thought you were gonna throw a curve. I was not ready for the fastball. Anybody that was around me during the election in 2016, especially since one of the classes that I taught at the University of Memphis was the class is called Rhetoric and Civic Controversy. So the controversy we studied was the election of 2016, fall of 2016. We followed the election in real time. And I like to talk about this class because it was the first time I did a class in live time, meaning that my syllabus was just like the first couple of days. I knew what we were going to do. Everything else was just blank because I had to stay up on the current events. So we began to actually study the rhetoric of Donald Trump. I teach rhetoric and communication, and I do rhetorical analysis. And all of a sudden, everybody in the class started to say, wait a minute, he's making appeals. It's not the normal type of appeals, but these appeals seem to be working, so much so that it eliminated anything negative that could happen to him. Everybody thought that the Hollywood access tape was just gonna, that was it? Nah, he had already garnered so much appreciation from his base that, as he said jokingly, but probably, you know, tongue in cheek, that, you know, I can shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue, my supporters would still support me. So what was happening is, though, an old appeal that is still relevant today. You cannot talk about this election without talking about 81% of white evangelicals supporting Donald Trump. And you can't talk about that without really beginning to understand the roots of white evangelicalism. It is grounded in race. It is grounded in racism. It is grounded in this whole notion that white supremacy, as we like to call it now, and understand it a little bit better, not white individuals, but the ideology, reigns supreme. So we can and I even begin to unpack, and people are still surprised, Meredith, I think, because they have not really addressed the elephant that's right there in the room. The question we should ask is why those appeals work in 2017. Why aren't those appeals heard and immediately rejected? Like, no, we're not even going down that road. We know where this road leads. And one of the reasons why not is because it is so profoundly American and so, you know, comforting at times. I hate to say it, but and people got wrapped up in that and then, you know, use every other excuse, especially as it relates to people of faith. So
Right. And that makes me ponder the question then of these Confederate statues, right? Where people are making these arguments that, well, this is our history. Right. This is not, you know, something that's painful, but they're actually not willing to acknowledge what it actually means.
This may surprise everybody in the room. I have no problem with the Confederate statues at all. I just think they should be erected in the Confederate States of America.
That's right.
have no problem. If the Confederate States of America want to erect statues of Nathan Bedford Father, Jefferson Davis, and all of the generals and war heroes and sheroes, that's fine. Just do it in the Confederate States of America.
Right.
It's their history. It's not the United States of America history.
Right. It is. It's a different nation. But let's talk about that. Okay, so in addition to your work as you've already claimed, you have so many titles. You have scholar, activist, pastor, all of these pieces of your life. You're also doing work with Take 'Em Down 901, which is also led by Tammy Sawyer, who I'll put in a very shameless plug, is going to be on Theology Live in December.
Right.
So I hope everyone will come back and hear her. So in light of our conversation, I've been thinking about this quote from Karl Rahner, who's a famous theologian, as you know, who says that all theology is also anthropology.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a few questions relating to this as well as the statue. So first, I wonder if you will basically just give us a history lesson. Tell us about when these statues were actually erected and for what purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would also love for you to give us some guidance as to why the removal of these statues is not just important, as you say, for our political history. This is not our country anymore, but also for our moral and theological history.
Well, you can't even understand the moral and theological positioning until you go back and understand the history. And when you understand the history, then you begin to realize that these statues were put up at a time when what we know as a white nationalism or white supremacy is really being strengthened. I think with the Nathan Bedford Forrest statue, 1905. So this is 10 years before Birth of a Nation. And that whole, quote, masterpiece that was shown in the White House and got the blessing of President then Woodrow Wilson as, I think the famous quote is, that it was like history written in lightning or with lightning, like, you know, this is the authentic history. Well, if that begins to be the authentic history, that African Americans were rapists and lazy and trifling and a whole lot of other stuff, and that whiteness was pure and virtuous, then that it was easy for the daughters of the Confederacy to go all around the country at the time, talking to individual cities, towns, states, and municipalities, trying to erect these statues in a time when white supremacy was really clamping down, when Jim and Jane Crow really was beginning to exert force. This is 1890. This is after 1896, Plessy v. Board of Education. We're in a class now studying Bishop Turner, and the class have already looked at the Reconstruction documentaries, and now they are beginning to understand the context in which gives rise to African Americans trying to fight against all of this oppression that was about to take place in this country. So these statues are not even erected after defeat of the Civil War. Matter of fact, many of the people that were defeated in the Civil War were shamed. We're shamed by this. We don't even want to talk about this. It took another generation to lift up the, quote, virtues of the Confederacy and to get them erected. So now we have over, 1,500 statues in this nation, not in the South, all over the country. Some of our own military bases are named after Confederate generals and people of the Confederacy. Do you understand what kind of rhetorical job, what masterpiece had to be done to get America to embrace a group of people that they defeated in a war? Think about that for a moment. Think about any that you could just, okay, we won, and, you know, your heroes and Shiro, we're going to lift them up and venerate them. And you can only do that. You can only do that when you're trying to marginalize or, you know, kick to the curb, as I like to say, blackness, and trying to make a statement that this is a white person's country, this will always be a white person's country, and this is the symbol that's going to do it. So that's why Take 'Em Down 901 exists, because we are speaking to the moral authority here trying to get people to understand that this is more than just a statue. It's not even part of our history. I don't even get in the history argument because, as I mentioned earlier, it's not even part of American history. So I think that's a red herring. I think this part of our history. No, it's not. Put it on Confederate States of America's of soul, and you can have them. You don't exist. Therefore, the statue should not exist.
I'm Meredith Day, and this is Theology Live. This evening, I'm with public theologian and professor of communications, the Reverend Dr. Andre Johnson. We are at Crosstown Concourse, and we are discussing what Christian theology has to say about the recent tragic events in Charlottesville and the movement for the removal of Confederate statues both in Memphis and around the United States. So, Dr. Johnson, you are also a scholar of communications, and so I have a question for you about communication.
Okay.
It could be argued that we are living in a world where actually more words are exchanged between human beings than ever before. So as a scholar of the study of communications, how have you or have you seen a shift in the way we communicate that might have contributed to our current political or social moment?
No, with the advent of social media and a whole lot of ways in which we can communicate, I think you're right. I think scholars have been trying to prove that and show that in the field, that there is a lot of verbiage and less listening, less real, honest, authentic dialogue. And it's very hard. It was one of the reasons why I don't get into Twitter beefs or Facebook chat beefs and stuff. If a person disagrees with me, I would just say, okay. They get mad. I just say, okay. Because it don't serve any purpose. It just really can't, but at least to me. And so you're absolutely right there. The only way to combat that is the slow, methodical way. You can't combat it by saying, oh, I'm going to put more words out there, right, and more verbiage. What you can do, though, is to do what we're doing in here, get into a small group, and begin to have authentic dialogue, agree to disagree. And that is the slow, methodical. It's slow. It's boring sometimes. You know, you don't think anything is getting done. But over time, that's the way to combat all the noise. Because you're absolutely right. When we are talking all the time, we're not listening. And you know what else we're not doing? We're not meditating. I don't even know what to say until I meditate, until I get quiet long enough. You know, as a minister and as a preacher, pastor, and before I even get up to preach, I have to be quiet. I got to get somewhere. I can't be, you know, I'm talking and verbalizing. Listening is very important. The inward journey, the outward journey, the whole meditation, the spiritual disciplines are still important, especially in a time such as these when noise is all over the place. So we have to do that. You're absolutely right.
Right. And in your previous episode, I listened to it again this week with Broderick, you so powerfully talk about how pretty much any other problem or issue we have in society, we will like to claim it's solved by talking about it, by saying things. And yet racism is the one that we as a society have sort of made ourselves believe if we just don't talk about it,
right. Then
it will magically go away. So as witnessed by this crowd here tonight, that there are people who want to have conversations. Yeah. And again, as you're speaking about the impact of this, I don't know what I would say, the slow work of God, from Teilhard de Chardin. How can white people enter into these conversations in a way that does not objectify or burden their black neighbors?
How about if I tell you can't sometimes? You got to take the risk. A lot of times, a lot of white people, and even with me being a man and talking about sexism or getting involved into important, like on the campus of the University of Memphis now, the president is going to have this big open discussion because a young lady was raped twice, you know, in like 20 days, and now there's some dialogue going on in that. In other words, all uncomfortable situations and conversations, you still have to jump in there and you got to take the risk. And here's my hard and fast rule on that. If we are in conversation, if we're in group, and you trust me, I trust you, and if you say something that's kind of like foul, okay, you get the benefit of the doubt. That's what we need to start talking more about instead of calling out people, this whole notion of calling in, just staying with. I don't like calling out or calling in. I just like staying with. I give you the benefit of the doubt to do that, to run the risk of saying something that might not be like, you know, rub me the wrong way, because I can tell you that you can apologize and we can move on. It's when I think it's frustrating to people of color when we know that white people want to get involved in the conversation and they're scared to say something. They're scared because they're walking on eggshells. They're trying to make sure they're not saying anything. They want to be right all the time. And you know what? We're not all right all the time. We're still profoundly human. We still gonna mess it up from time to time. Grace and mercy must extend if we are going to have real serious conversation. So if you're at the table, I'm gonna assume that you're not the enemy, right? You're not opposing, you're trying to work this thing out. Now, you know, if we can't agree, then we can agree to, you know, go our separate ways. But until that time, we got to be able to be open and to share and to do that type of work. And you just can't be scared. Also, now, that's when you are, you know, being inclusive in here, right? But the real work that white people got to do is with their own families and with their own communities. You got to go back. You got to go and have those conversations at Thanksgiving. You can't let Uncle Joe get away with the racist joke anymore. You got to call them out. Got to say, that's not cool, Unc. I love you, but that's not cool. And when all this stuff is going to be, you know, rounds football and why they kneeling, why they try to explain, if you really know and understand that argument, even if you don't agree, just say, here's their side. Try to do that work instead of laughing along or just trying to, you know, hope that, you know, grandmama shut up. I mean, that's the real work. Because guess what? I'm not going to be invited in those conversations. You know, that's the conversation you got to have. And that's the conversations going back to your very first question about being surprised. I'm thinking about that skit on Saturday Night Live with Chris Rock and Dave Chappelle was the two black guys in the room, and everybody was just shocked and surprised, and they were like, really, really? And part of that is that we have not really engaged, or should I say white people. White people have not really engaged their families, and it's not even hidden racism. It's just this overt, just like wide open type of race. You knew you had Trump voters in your family. You knew that. They told you. And you still shocked? No. Just talk to amongst your friends and you can count them up. And you're like, wow, I'm running out of fingers here. We got a whole, I'm running out of toes. Because there are a whole lot of people that were supporting Trump that we love, though. And that's the kicker. And I know it's tough and I know it's hard that we care about. Man, that they raised me. But golly, you're so wrong. And that's tough. And I understand that, but it has to be done if we're really gonna do this work.
Right.
And we got to, as people of color, got to be there to help embrace some of the pain, some of the hurt, because that's real too. A lot of people are kicked out or exiled from family because of that, and I know that. So I've talked to a lot of folk that had that happen to them.
What a gracious and compassionate answer. I mean, truly, that is incredibly compassionate, all that you just said. The last time you were with us on Theology Live, you were talking with Broderick primarily about this hashtag, White Church Quiet, and you mentioned that as well. And I wonder if you would just, it's been almost a year, I suppose, if you would just give us kind of an update on how that has, you know, been shaped and formed and just kind of the movement and momentum over the last year.
Well, it started as a response to the no response that I felt the white church wasn't, you know, offering in the death of black people at the hands of police. So when Philando Castile, if you remember him, out of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, and down in Baton Rouge, Alton Sterling, after their death, I just took to Twitter and just like, you know, come on, man, you know, white church choir, come on, what, you got to say something about this. So I'm scouring the, and it's, you know, a few people here and there, but no major statement, no like a bank, like white ministers coming to a banker microphone saying enough is enough and all of that. So I started doing that and got a lot of feedback from individuals who were frustrated at their churches as well, too. They were saying, yeah, we went to church and it was not even listed as in the prayers. Just, you know, not expecting the minister to preach a sermon on, you know, police brutality, but at least with the prayers of the people, can you just, you know, to all the slain bodies that, you know, something, just throw that line in there or something, you know, in your name we pray, you know, but nothing. So we've been getting just to going back and forth, and I did a tweet chat and did about three of them and really found a community out there that was really frustrated with their own church. These are white people, frustrated with their church's response to not only racism, but sexism and LGBTQ issues and a whole lot of other stuff. So much so now that, and I got to give him a shout out, Christopher Stroop, who is, if you're not following him, you should on Twitter. He started the hashtag Empty the Pews, because that's one of the things that we are calling for as well, that stop supporting your own oppression, you know, type of deal. So, you know, some of these churches are big and prosperous because people are still going there. They're still giving. They're still working. You know, sooner or later, you know, you're going to have to stop doing that. So he's talking about emptying the pews and stuff like that. But now this thing has taken a life of its own. I've been around the country. I've been talking about this thing. I'm working on a book, actually, that's tentatively titled White Church, Quiet, Donald Trump, Race, and White Evangelical Church, and the White Evangelical Church. And basically what I'm going to argue is that white evangelical churches have always been problematic when it comes to race. A lot of arguments have been, well, the church changed, the evangelicals changed, and that's why they voted for Trump. They are no longer sticking to their values. No, when it comes to race, they're still sticking to their values, as evident of Charlottesville. Many of those same marchers who were marching when our hoods are wide and open were and will tell you to a person, they are followers of Jesus. But they would not like me and do not like me, who think that I should just be blown off the face of the earth. I mean, and we have to talk about that. We just have to say, okay, but that has been, for the history of this country, the primary majority view of Christianity. There's no other way we could have had enslaved people in this country, no other way we could have treated natives like we did, with no other way that we could treat women like we did, the labor movement, any of those type of movements with religion. Yes, there were a few people in religion and faithful folk, abolitionists and whole host of other people who stood against that, but just read the documents. The majority of the church was hook, line, sinker, anti-black. So basically what I want to talk about in the book is, I talk about Trump a little bit, but I also want to give a little history about how we got to this point and if we are ever going to break out of it, some of the things that we need to do. And one of the things is just, you know, empty the pews. We just need to leave toxic churches and stop supporting them. My trust to get up in the morning and to do this work is in God, instead of humans or anything that we can kind of construct together. But I think we are called to live in the tension and try to eke out the best existence possible with groups of people that love us, that nurture us, that care about us, that strengthen us, that empower us. I think that we are called to live in the tension and find that peace of happiness and that joy and that can get us to the next day and the next day and the next week. I think we ought to live in the tension and that we can find that peace of mind, that peace that passes all understanding, and that we can then, even if this racism is never eradicated, at least in our lifetime, we can still say, along with God, that the creation was good, that we found some goodness in some of the people made in the image of God, and that we together try to form the best community that we can form. And I think that's the best that we can do and the best that we can offer. And, you know, if that's the best, then that has to be good enough for me. And I think it should be good enough for all of us.
Wow, Dr. John, you have given us so much to think about, and we are truly blessed and grateful for your presence tonight. So please give Dr. Johnson a very, very round of applause.
Thank you.
In the Episcopal tradition, there are many times in our liturgy that we are asked as Christians to remember our baptism. While many of us were baptized as infants or as young children, this can sound like an impossible task. But it is not so much a call to recollect the details of the event, but to remember that the event, in fact, happened. We remember we are baptized and therefore claim an identity in the divine household. In these times of remembrance in the liturgy, we call to mind our baptismal covenant, which requires the answering of 8 questions from the celebrant. In the face of an America that does not yet acknowledge the sanctity of all bodies, the last of these 8 questions is germane to all individuals and churches that claim a Christological heritage. The priest asks, "Will you strive for justice and peace among all people, and respect the dignity of every human being?" May our answer be the same tonight as it has been for generations upon generations. I will, with God's help. Theology Live is a ministry of Grace St. Luke's Episcopal Church, a welcoming community of faith in the heart of Midtown Memphis. This episode of Theology Live was engineered and edited by Mr. Noah Glenn, who also composed our theme music. We offer special thanks to Ms. Lauren Hales and the entire staff of the Church Health Center for offering their space here at Crosstown Concourse this evening. Our visual artist, Mr. Josh Colfer, our hospitality coordinators, Ms. Kathleen Hansen and Ms. Nikki Glenn, and our caterers, Mama Gaia. Of course, we offer much gratitude to our guest this evening, the Reverend Dr. Andre Johnson. You can follow him on Twitter at A.E. Johnson, Ph.D. Join us back here at Crosstown Concourse on November 16th as I interview the Reverend Verzola Law, senior pastor of Lindenwood Christian Church in Memphis. Also, don't miss our special episode of Theology Live released just a few weeks ago, where the interviewer was turned interviewee as I sat down with the Reverend Broderick Greer, former host of Theology Live. Visit us at 901theology.com and follow us on Twitter at 901theology or on Instagram at Theology Live for updates about our episodes and events. If you have not already subscribed to Theology Live on your preferred podcast platform, then help enhance our digital visibility by reviewing us on iTunes. Thank y'all for listening.